All right, good morning. And happy Father's Day. Or, as we refer to it around our house, the Day of Kings. So, may all the subjects in your realm come and bow before you and shower you with gifts and honor and praise today. Yeah, it doesn't happen to me either, but it's a dream. So happy Day of Kings to all of you dads out there. We are in the book of Romans chapter 4. Romans 4, we're going to pick up today with verse 13. And we'll read through verse 17. So Romans chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be heir of the world did not come through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For it is, if it is the adherents of the law who are to be heirs, faith is null and the promise is void. For the law brings wrath, but where there is no law, there is transgression. That is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may rest on grace and be guaranteed to all his offspring, not only to the adherent of the law, but also to the one who shares the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made you the father of many nations, in the presence of the God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. Still talking about Abraham here in chapter 4, primarily of the book of Romans. And so as we've made our way through this chapter, we've been witness to the Apostle Paul taking on a series of opponents or enemies, if you will, of the gospel of justification by grace through faith. And these opponents have been quite formidable. So far in our studies, we've looked at two of them. The first one was works. So this enemy of the gospel is the one that almost everyone believes in. It is actually the crowd favorite. I'll be saved by the good works that I do. And as you're out in society talking to people, this is the overwhelming opinion that you'll run into of most people. So, but Paul defeated this idea when he cited Genesis 15:6, which says that Abraham was justified by his faith in the promise of God, not by his works. And since he's put forth Abraham as the pattern of justified, godly men of the Old Testament, that sets the pattern for all that follow him. So works was what we first encountered. The second opponent to this idea of justification by faith is circumcision. We looked at this last week. This opponent, this champion against the gospel was peculiar to the Jews, but it, as we talked about last week, it can be extended into our beliefs about our sacraments as well. So Paul defeats this just by showing that Abraham was declared to be justified by God before he was even circumcised, before circumcision was imposed upon him and his followers, his heirs, the other Jewish people, by a number of years. Would we say 14 years later? So the last of these three enemies, the one that comes up today, is law. So the works, circumcision, and now law are the opponents that Paul is taking on. And he's going to attack this enemy in these next two paragraphs here in Romans chapter 4, and that would be verses 13 through 17. Now, one thing to point out is there is a change here in Paul's strategy. When he dealt with the opponent, the idea of circumcision, he used a temporal or historical, you know, having to do with time argument. And we've seen that. he showed that Abraham was justified when he was about 85 years old in Genesis 15:6. But he was not given the right of circumcision until Genesis 17, when Abraham was 99 years old. So again, he set the idea up that he couldn't have been justified by something that came into existence after he was declared to be justified. That type of argument could also have been used for today's opponent, the law. In fact, there's a similar discussion as this one over in the book of Galatians, and that's what Paul does. Over in Galatians chapter 3, starting in verse 17, Paul says, "This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise, but God gave it to Abraham by a promise." So there, Paul is very much playing the historical, temporal card. It's an argument from history. And it's even stronger, I guess you could say, than the argument against circumcision, because rather than just 14 years, we're talking about 430 years. But Paul doesn't use that argument here in Romans chapter 4. And we're not sure exactly why he chose a different tact here, but it could be because law here in Romans 4 could have a slightly different meaning than it does over in Galatians chapter 3. Given the context of the trouble that the Galatian church was having, and we went over this a few weeks ago, the word law most certainly refers to the Mosaic law, the law given to Moses. You remember that Jews came into the church and demanded that the Christians obey this Mosaic law, including being circumcised. And so you can be pretty confident that in that passage, when Paul is referring to law, that's what he's talking about, the Mosaic law. But here in Romans chapter 4, things are slightly different. And when you look at verse 13, in the Greek language in which this was originally written, there is no definite article. There is no word "the" in front of the law. That is placed there by translators later. And so what that signifies here is that Paul was most likely not speaking only of the Mosaic law, but of God's law in general, and all of God's commandments and all of God's standards. He was also speaking, you could say, of the principal idea of law keeping. And that's what many Jews trusted in for their salvation. So here, this morning, I'll occasionally refer to this idea just to keep from being confusing as the law principle, this principle of obeying the law. You could even generalize it even further by using the word morality. So it's not just the Mosaic law here in Romans 4 that Paul is talking about. And that could be why he didn't cite the timeline of the coming of the Mosaic law, which was 430 years after Abraham. Here, Paul speaks of the results of trying to live by the law. He's going to show that by its own nature, the law is contrary to both faith and to promise. And then the only inevitable result of living this way is God's wrath. That's what he's going to tell us. Now, some of you know I like to read. One of the books that I have, it's one of the more recent books that I've purchased, written by Dr. R.C. Sproul, is called The Consequences of Ideas. Or the Consequences of Ideas, I can't remember. And what he does in the book is he takes famous philosophers, he states their positions of which they're known for, and then he tells what the consequences of holding that viewpoint are, especially from a Christian worldview. And I haven't read it all the way through. I use it more as a reference book if a particular philosopher comes up in something that I'm reading, I'll go to it. But I really like the book just based on the title, because it just affirms again that the ideas that we have, the things that we believe, have consequences. And sometimes we flitter around between ideas and between beliefs and doctrines and principles as if they have no consequences. But they do. The things you believe have consequences. And I believe here this morning in Romans chapter 4, Paul is going to point out consequences of trying to achieve a state of being saved by following the law. Not by faith, but by morality, adherence to the law. He's going to share consequences of that viewpoint, that idea. So he has three. The first one in verse 14 is that faith would have no value. If salvation is achieved through the law, then faith would have no value. We get that in verse 14, where it says, "For if it is the adherents of the law who are able to be heirs," of course, the adherents to the law, he's talking about anyone who perfectly obeys the laws of God and all other laws for that fact. "For if it is the adherents of the law who are to be heirs, faith is null." And the reason that faith would have no value if you're living by the law principle is that in the context of salvation, faith and the law are opposites. If a person is choosing one, again, when it comes to salvation, he is rejecting the other. It's impossible to be saved by both faith and works. It would be like leaving here for California and New York at the same time. It just can't be done. Here's an example. We've talked in here before about Donald Gray Barnhouse. He's a pastor that I respect and have read some of his stuff. But he once produced a gospel film called The Geography of Salvation. The Geography of Salvation. And it was based on the idea that in the continental United States, both the highest point, which is Mount Whitney, and the lowest point, which is Death Valley, are in the same state, the state of California. So he compared the state of California to this state of being lost and you needing to change to a state of being saved. And he said it's impossible to get out of California simply by going up. For example, if you're in the lowest part of Death Valley, 282 feet below sea level, it's called Badwater Basin, and you climbed up out of that and actually got to the mountains and got to Mount Whitney, 14,494 feet, and climbed to the very top, you will have changed a lot in elevation, but you're still in the state of California. You cannot get out that way. Similarly, he says, in regard to salvation, what we need is not just a higher moral elevation change, but we need a change of state. We need to be moved out of our lost state, in which we are under the wrath of God, and into a saved state. This is different than just moving up, and it's accomplished in a completely different way. To put it another way, you could say it like this: law is man-directed. It points to human abilities. That's what laws are. Whereby faith is God-directed. It points to God's accomplishments and God's promises and God's faithfulness. So if you're approaching salvation by trusting man, yourself, and keeping the law, then you cannot be trusting God, and vice versa. So The first thing we learn is faith is made null. But there's a second consequence of this idea, and that is that the promise is worthless. Again, in verse 14. For if it is the adherents of the law who are to be the heirs, you move on a phrase later, it says, then the promise is void. The promise is void. So we're nullifying or voiding God's promise if we're living by this law principle. This idea of being saved simply by keeping a moral set of laws. So why does it void the promise? And here's why. If the promise of God is linked in any way to a law principle, then the only way, that means that the only way possible to get the promise is to keep those laws. God could have made his plan that way, but it would have meant that his promise was conditional. It would have been like God saying, I promise to save you if you will do so and so. But if that were the case, the promise would never have been fulfilled, because Paul has already told us in Romans that there is nobody who does what God's law requires. In fact, I think if you were to study sociology and anthropology even more closely, you would find that there is no one who perfectly does what any law or set of laws requires. For whenever a person says, this is my standard, no sooner has he erected that standard, but he breaks it. It's our nature. And so this would exclude him from salvation if salvation was based on fulfilling those demands of the law. So the promise would be void because of your behavior. The promise could exist, but it would be worthless in terms of saving everybody or anybody. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones has an interesting quote. He puts it like this, law means failure. Therefore, if the promise had been made through the medium of the law, what God was giving, as it were, with his right hand, he would have been taking back with his left hand. There would have been no promise at all. It would have had no value whatsoever. So this idea of attaining your salvation by adherence to the law nullifies the promise. The third thing it does is it brings wrath. Verse 15, very first phrase. For the law brings wrath. So here, this consequence of trying to achieve, again, a saved status by law-keeping is that this actually tells you what you can accomplish. It goes beyond what's already been said. In these first two, we've told you what you're not able to do. You cannot, or it nullifies the faith and voids the promise. These things you cannot achieve. The one thing you can achieve is wrath, God's wrath. And the reason is the law can do nothing but condemn. That's its very essence. The law says, do this, and if you do not do it, the punishment is as follows. That's law. That's what it is. The law possesses nothing that can enable a person to meet its demands. It just says, here are the demands. Does that mean the law is evil? Well, we're going to get into this in some detail when we get over to Romans chapter 7. But we can look at just a couple of verses this morning, starting with verse 7. Paul says, what then shall we say? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. And then verse 12. So the law is holy. And the commandment is holy and righteous and good. So the law isn't defective. We compared the law in a previous sermon to a mirror that you look into. And the mirror is not defective because it cannot clean your face. That's not the job of the mirror. The function of the mirror is to show you that your face is dirty, so that when you know it's dirty, you go get some soap and water and you clean it off. In the same way, the law is not defective because it cannot save you. That is not its function. The law was given to show you that you cannot get to heaven by keeping it. So that having learned that, you'll turn to Jesus Christ and be saved by him. So, if you do not turn from the law as a way of salvation and trust the work of God, the very standard that you trust, that is the law, condemns you. Because you've never kept all of it and you never will. What does Paul mean at the end of verse 15 when he says, "But where there is no law, there is no transgression"? Well, this could mean the obvious. It could mean if there's no law, there can be no transgression of that law. But in the context here, I believe it probably means something like, without the law, we don't know that we are transgressors. We just read in verse 7 of chapter 7, "If it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin." It's like, if it wasn't for the mirror, I wouldn't know my face was dirty. So then we can deduce that there's nothing wrong with the law. The problem is in us. And the law's sole function is to bring that truth to our attention. So it nullifies faith. It voids the promise. And it brings God's wrath. There must be a better way. In most of your English translations, you'll see that today's passage is broken up into two paragraphs. At least it's that way in the English Standard Version, which we read from this morning, and the New International Version. Some versions start every verse on a new line, so it's hard to know what they're thinking there. That makes it easier to read, but you lose the nuance of the writing. Because I think that break, those paragraph breaks like that, are proper in this instance. Because the first paragraph, what we've read so far, is negative. It deals with the bad consequences of trying to be saved by the law principle. Devaluation of faith, voiding of the promise, and God's wrath. The second paragraph, the one we turn to now, is positive. It shows the fortunate consequences of seeking God by faith. Not on the basis of morality or the law principle, but by faith, which was the path pursued by Abraham. So let's look at this again in this case, but on the other side of the ledger, we're going to see three consequences. So the first one in verse 16 is that faith establishes grace. Faith establishes grace. Verse 16 says, "That is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may rest on grace." So why is this so? Well, I think we can understand it this way, because faith and grace belong together the same way, on the other side of the ledger, works and law belong together. We can obviously see it in the latter case of works and law. Law tells us what we are to do. It points to deeds and actions and conduct and behavior, works. You cannot think of law without thinking of its requirements. So in the same way, though by contrast, as soon as you think of faith, you inevitably think of grace if you understand those terms. And as soon as you think of grace, you think of faith. Grace, we know, is the unmerited favor of God. It's apart from human works. And it comes to us by simple acceptance, which is faith. I mean, suppose I agree to work for you for a day, for $100. I don't know what I could do for you all day. I don't have a very elaborate skill set. But you liked it, and you thought it was worth $100. So I come to your house, and I work all day doing whatever it is. Playing with your children comes to mind. $500. Let's say I'm going to work for you all day for $500, and I do that, and you pay me. Would you claim that you were being gracious in doing that? Let's assume that that's the going rate for playing with your children. No, you can't claim that you're being gracious. Your payment is not a matter of grace, but rather it's a matter of obligation, because you and I agreed that I would work all day in exchange for this set amount of pay. And so I fulfilled my obligation. It's time for you to fulfill yours. There is no grace involved at all. If, on the other hand, let's say I'm sick and I'm out of a job and I have expenses and I need some assistance, and you decide to give me the $500. It has nothing to do with anything that I've done or will do. That's grace. And I have only to receive your gift and to thank you for it. Faith establishes grace. Therefore, we have to have faith, because it's grace that we need. The second consequence that is somewhat better than the first three is faith makes salvation certain. It makes salvation certain. Verse 16 again. That is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may, and then go to the next phrase, be guaranteed to all his offspring. Be guaranteed. And again, we can see this by contrasting it. Suppose salvation was based on our ability to keep some law or to live up to some standard of morality. One famous writer on this topic was a man named Robert Bella, and he wrote a book in 1985. It was more of a study, statistical study, of American mores, and he titled it Habits of the Heart. And he writes in there about a man whose most basic moral standard was honesty. So let's just use that this morning. If salvation depends upon us being honest, how honest do we have to be? I mean, here we have a very honest man. Let's let him into heaven. Now here we have another man. He's almost as honest as the first man, but he told one more lie than the other man did. Should we let him in? If so, what about a man who's told one more lie than this guy, or 10 more lies? How about a man who's only moderately truthful, or a man who's quite dishonest? Where do you draw the line? Well, I'm sure you can imagine that in an imperfect and variable world, very intricately variable world in which we live, it would be impossible to draw such a line, unless the line is absolute perfection, which no one would attain. So if anyone wants to be saved by works, they can never be certain that they've performed well enough. If the standard is utter perfection, which it must be to please a perfect God, then you know you've never attained enough. But let's blur this a little and say the standard doesn't have to be perfection, but there is a standard. You'll never know whether you've attained it or not. And it's the same for any other moral trait or character quality. Use purity, contentment, charity, whatever. How pure? How content? How generous do you have to be? By contrast, however, if salvation is not by morality, by this law principle, but it's by the grace of God received through faith, then salvation is certain, because God is faithful and he doesn't waver in his promises. He's done what's necessary through the work of Jesus Christ. That work is perfect and it's all sufficient. Nothing can be added to it. So the person who rests on that work can be quietly content and confident. Their salvation is certain. The third consequence Paul points out is that faith opens the door of salvation to all. Verse 16 says, not only to the adherent of the law, but also to the one who shares the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Salvation opens the door of, this way of salvation through faith rather than morality, opens the door of salvation to everybody, not just to the Jew who possessed the Old Testament law, or not even to the Gentiles who were perhaps raised according to another standard of morality. All may enter. Whoever will may come. And this is the point that Paul has been making here in chapter 4, at least since verse 9, is that this is not exclusive to the Jewish people, that all may come. And you know, I don't know of any other human benefit or award or promise that you can say this about. Because all human offers have conditions and thereby always exclude someone. I mean, there are certain benefits to being an American citizen that are only available to citizens. If you're not a citizen, you don't get the benefit. And I think the only one left like that is paying taxes. So we have the privilege of paying taxes as U.S. citizens, and if you're not, you don't get to do that. Companies make promises to their employees. And they could vary from profit-sharing plans to paying for higher education. There are all kinds of promises that companies make, but it's only to their employees. If you don't work for them, then the promise is not for you. Labor unions provide various securities for their members, but only their members. Any worker who's not a member, or even worse, management, they don't get any of that. Any human association has built-in limitations. This is not true of the way of salvation offered by God through the work of Christ. Because of this, I can say the door is open for you regardless of who you are, regardless of what you've done, or regardless of what you haven't done. If you're a Jew, the gospel is for you. If you're a Gentile, it is for you. It is for those who are good. It's for those who are bad. It's for scholars as well as the uneducated. It's for religious people as well as for those who have no religious background at all. None of these things enter into the picture because we're all reduced to the same level, and that is sinners in need of God's grace. Salvation is by the grace of God through faith. So if you're excluded, it's only because you have refused to walk through that door that's open to you. It's because you prefer your own sullied morality to the grace of God. Don't let that be true of you. Instead of refusing grace, accept it and enter into the full joy of God's salvation. That salvation is for you, whoever you may be, if you'll have it. Now today, we've looked at several principles from Romans 4. If you seek to earn your salvation by this law principle, by law keeping, by morality, then you state by your ideas that faith has no value, that the promise of God is worthless, and that all you get in return is God's wrath. Salvation is yours by God's grace alone, through faith alone. This teaches us that God's grace is the foundation for our salvation, that this makes salvation certain, and that this salvation is available to all. It's yours this morning for the taking. Won't you make it your own? I'm going to ask our worship team to return to the stage as we close this morning. Paul is so caught up, it seems, in this doctrine of justification by faith alone that he cannot seem to let go of it. It's got him. It's captured him. And he must teach it. You know, I'm reminded, speaking of that, several months ago, a friend of mine and I together read through and studied through the book of Jonah. And there are all kinds of lessons in the book of Jonah for you to learn. But the one that really struck me, and the only one that's really stayed with me of all of those lessons, is the absolute danger of not saying what God tells you to say. You remember the story. God talked to Jonah and said, "Hey, you know the city over there, Nineveh?" And he said, "Yeah, I know it." He said, "I want you to go tell them that in 40 days I'm going to destroy them because of their wickedness." Well, Jonah knew that God was gracious and merciful. We learn that later in the book. And he didn't want to go tell them because he was afraid God would forgive them. So Jonah ran away. You know the story. He ran the opposite direction. He got on a ship. By doing that, he put the lives of the sailors of that ship in great danger. They were fearful for their lives. And they asked, "Is there someone on board who has offended their God?" And Jonah finally had to confess that it was him. And so they threw him overboard to save their own lives. So Jonah first endangered the sailors, then himself, but also he endangered the people he was supposed to go speak to, who had 40 days to live, essentially. And he basically just said, "To heck with you. Go on, be destroyed. I don't care." That would have been the result had he never gone. But as you know, he was swallowed by the great fish from the deep, taken down for a few days to think about things. And while there, he repented. So God made the fish spit him up on the land. He went to Nineveh, and he said what God had told him to say originally. And the people did repent in sackcloth and ashes, and God spared them. It's very dangerous to not say what God has told us to say. And we know, for us, he's told us to say the gospel to people who need to hear it. For the society around us, he's told us to speak so that we are salt and light to the people around us. What about people in here? We have people in here going through all kinds of trials and pain and illness. In Ephesians, it tells us that we're to talk to each other as well, and we're to speak the truth in love, not platitudes. Not cliched meanings that are only meant to communicate that you care because you nod your head when you say them. But truth and love. And what is the truth when someone's going through a trial? Well, I would hope it's something about God being sovereign and that God loves you and that things work out for His glory and your good when you belong to Him. Dan and I learned those truths the hard way over about a 30-year period of those very trials. And so we know them now in hindsight. We should be encouraging each other by speaking the truth in love so that people will know these truths and foresight before they need them. Paul is seized by what God has told him to tell people. In chapter 1, right at the beginning, it may be verse 1, he says he's called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel. In verse 15, he says he's eager to share the gospel. And in verse 16, he says, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel. That's why he keeps saying it over and over. That's why when you come in here week after week, you hear the same thing. Paul is compelled to teach this. And you know, maybe he didn't do enough, because it seems that in every generation, people rise up against the idea of justification by faith. And they want to be saved by any other way, by their own merit, by their own works, by the church that they belong to. And the list goes on and on. This morning, Paul is pressed home again, this example of Abraham, by describing Abraham's faith, God's grace, and God's promise. Works cannot save us. Circumcision, baptism, the Lord's Supper, confirmation doesn't save you. The law principle or the Mosaic law, general morality, cannot save you. Only by God's grace through faith. Sola gratia, sola fide. Let's pray.